subject is the book of Revelation. And I guess earlier in my stay, last week one time, I alluded to the fact that early in my first parish, a group of people wanted to study the Bible, and they assumed that they could pick any book they wanted to, so they hit on the book of Revelation. I told them that I hadn't studied it at the seminary, and they didn't believe that because they figured, you know, after all, what do? If you spend 3 years there and you don't cover the whole Bible, there must be something wrong. So they thought I was kidding them. But after a few weeks, they discovered that it was correct, that I had indeed not studied the book of Revelation. And so we gave up and took 1 Corinthians. I don't know if we'd studied that one either, but at least it was a little easier book to begin on our own. This morning, I'd like to try to cover about a third of the book, and that obviously is a too difficult task for a very short period, but I hope we can hit a few high spots and point out some things which may be of assistance in your own study of the book, and invite you to begin with prayer with me. O Lord, reveal yourself to your people. They are so weak, often so discouraged, so fearful, so threatened, so lacking in courage. But you are strong and also merciful. We entrust to you our whole future as well as our today. Help us to walk in faith one step at a time. Amen. As far as the book of Revelation is concerned, it belongs to a kind of literature that was used over a relatively short period of time in history. You can find some literary forms that are in use from the ancient period up until today. We were singing hymns here, and if you go back in ancient Near Eastern literature, you'll find hymns that are, I suppose, 3,000-4,000 years old. We're still using that form. I don't know of anyone today who is writing apocalypses. There was only a short period of 300 or maybe 400 years when this form was used. That poses great problems for us because while we may have some notions of how to go about studying an epistle, a letter, or a hymn, or history, we really don't grow up with the literary form of apocalypse. And so, since it's so strange, we run into a number of difficulties with it. I think that its content is not utterly unique, maybe more so its form. The form, I don't know of anyone who has really analyzed this as well as it ought to be done, but maybe you can think of some of the forms that are in there that have to do with its structure and its literary qualities. It, to me, seems to be a very mixed bag, this apocalyptic literature. You have, in some cases, you do have hymns. You'll find a few of those in the book of Revelation. You have almost like an epistle. The book of Revelation begins like a letter, as if it were, you know, to the church of Philadelphia, write such and such. It sounds like at the beginning and then perhaps also at the end, as if it were an epistle, but it really isn't that either. There are in some apocalypses what one might call some historical surveys of the long period of history and periodizing of it, putting it into eras or eons. There is perhaps a golden eon, an iron eon, a brass one, stone or whatever. And those surveys are variously understood as either pre-written history, at least some think that it is maybe almost in total that. Others say it's largely history written after the fact and is not pre-written so much except perhaps at the very ends of each of these historical surveys, they tend to bring history up to the present moment and then project, maybe just briefly, into the future, a note of hope as to how history is going to turn out. Well, these are just a few. Perhaps as we go along, we can find other forms in there, in the book. We have also maybe speak a little bit about the content. Usually, form and content go together quite well, and in this instance, I think that's true with the Book of Revelation. It's, as far as I can tell, a kind of crisis literature, and so it is seeking to bring hope and courage and confidence to the Christian community that is undergoing persecution and is in danger of even greater persecution, suffering, and death. And so it focuses in very much on the sovereignty of God as Lord of history, who knows really what he's doing. He's not caught off guard by petty rulers one place or another. He has brought history up to this moment, and he is in control and will bring it to its ultimate goal. It should give comfort to Christians, and in the case of Old Testament and intertestamental apocalypses, comfort to Jewish peoples. The Jews used this form before Christians did, and used it perhaps more than the Christian church. Focusing in then on on God's power, but I think it isn't just enough to know that God is powerful. He might be powerful and be an awful tyrant. The Jews to whom the book of Daniel was written knew about power. The Christians to whom the book of Revelation was written knew the power of the Roman state. And that was no comfort to them at all. So they had to be addressed also in terms of God's love and his faithfulness to his people, that in fact his guidance of history was for the sake of this chosen people of God. And he would guide them through to the end. All that was required of them was really to trust him, to be faithful to him, to lead them to their eternal goal. Now, in the case of the book of Revelation, it may sound, depending on how you read it, as though maybe Christians will be let off and not have to suffer very much. I have brought with me the Scofield Bible, which reads it that way, that people of God are kind of raptured out of all this veil of tears, and they'll be, during the final great tribulation and suffering in the world, up there enjoying high tea or something, looking down on this terrible situation that gets worse and worse. But I don't read it that way. I think it is intended to promise Christians eternal life, that many of them in fact are going to be martyred, but that they ought not to fear that, that the Lord who himself died is alive, and so also will they be alive in spite of their deaths, because he is as the one who has the power and the keys of death and Hades, and he promises them this eternal life. There is perhaps a view of history involved in Apocalypse that runs a bit counter to what we found in the prophets. In the prophets, the nation of Israel usually is called to repent and to change its course of action, to turn back to God and away from some of these trusting in other countries for in political alliances for their future, or worshiping other gods rather than faithfulness to Israel's own God. And it's assumed that a change of direction on the part of Israel will in fact change the course of their history, will rescue them. I think that the threats of the prophets, which are God's threats after all, they're his mouthpiece, are largely conditional. They don't say it that way, well, if you don't do so and so, this is the way it's going to turn out. That would take the edge off their message, I think. They just say, yet 40 days and Nineveh will be destroyed. But when Nineveh repented, Nineveh was not destroyed, you see. That, I think, suggests, that's one illustration, that the threats were conditional. That the course of history could be altered, that God himself could also repent of the evil which he had threatened to do and not do it. In apocalyptic, I don't... Well, there might be exceptions, but generally, I don't find that. History seems to be just willy-nilly on a course that it's impossible to change. It doesn't call on Nebuchadnezzar or anybody to change the course of history, you know, or the Jews, or the people of the book of Revelation. They're almost on a treadmill, and it's just a matter of kind of waiting it out. In fact, it's a kind of deterministic view of history that seems to be there, and things are pretty well planned by God already, and they will, of course, turn out all right, but perhaps one could say they seem to have to get worse before they get better. And it's this period, the immediate future, which is that terrible period, which is portrayed in rather ghastly tones in Revelation. Christians are going to have to do more than just wait it out. They're going to have to really stand firm in the power of God's Spirit and trust that in spite of anything that might happen to them, they are on the winning side. And the danger is that they'll misread the signals, and they will believe that Roman power is ultimate power, and they'll give in and do what Rome asks them to do, be unfaithful in their Christian commitment, and then they'll lose out on the crown of life. So the book seeks, I think, in its content to tell about this horrible prospect of terrible persecution, but also to say because that is a very misleading experience, get the opinion, the wrong impression that God is somehow, things have gone out of control, that he is not Lord of all history, but continue to trust because you know in advance. It's a very realistic kind of literature, I think. It doesn't paint a rosy picture. Tells people exactly what it's going to be like. Don't, however, give up, because the future really belongs to God, and he's giving it as a gift to his people, a glorious future. Okay, now, the book. The opening words, I discovered, much to my chagrin, I guess I brought along the wrong version of the Bible. I had some time ago already, in working with the Good News in mimeographed form out there in Africa, we used it as one of the versions to which to make comparisons with the Jerusalem Bible, which was the major one they were using. I discovered that it is a very free translation. And the opening words go here, the book, this book is the record of the events that Jesus Christ revealed. And I don't think that Norman is faithful to the Greek at all. I checked out Nancy's copy last evening, and it's to me it's the apocalypse of Jesus Christ. It's the revelation of Jesus Christ. It would be, I think, the most faithful translation of those opening words. And so... I think King James Version, or here I have one, I only bring it along because occasionally I don't know what Schofield Bible says, so kind of like to be able to check up on it. Schofield is basically King James, I think, but he makes quite a few changes here and there too. And his is more faithful to the Greek than Good News is. Well, my point is, makes a great difference how you read this book, whether you think it's focusing in on the future events just as a kind of timetable into the future, so that you have a chart perhaps as to exactly what's going to happen, so that you don't have to even say worry about tomorrow because you know exactly what's coming up, or if you look at it somewhat as Norman was suggesting last week, one look at the parables as a Christ-centered book. I think that in chapter 1 of Revelation, one really has a key to the whole book. And there's a little, but not terribly much, about those events. But there is a great deal about Jesus Christ. It's really a revelation of Jesus Christ. Of course, what he's going to do, but the focus is on him. And so, this morning I'd like to begin by just focusing in chapter 1 on the many titles for Jesus Christ in chapter 1 of Revelation. You put those end to end and take them out of the book, out of the chapter, you have not much left. It's just a list of various ways of knowing him, experiencing him, and trusting him. Well, I put them here on paper because I figured time would go very quickly. Maybe some of you have Bibles with you, and sometimes they may be translated a little differently than here. I took them out of Good News. Hope they're not too badly translated. Chapter 1, verse 1, Jesus Christ. Well, of course, we're not surprised by that title, but it is both a personal name and a title. I think it ties together two very important experiences of the Christian community. Some, perhaps at this time, very few, had known Jesus, who walked the streets and roads of Palestine, and healed the sick, and had a very compassionate and important ministry to his people, and who finally ended up on the cross, and who was, by at least a few, identified as the Christ, the one who was to come. A title, the Anointed One, promised, as we looked last week, some of you perhaps were here, in the Old Testament, promised by God as a successor to David. Well, New Testament, many places, identifies him that way. Verse 5 is just full of them, of these titles: faithful witness, firstborn son, one raised from the dead, ruler of the kings of this world. In addition to titles, of course, there are many verbs, actions, and things which Christ is said to do as well as to be in this chapter. Some of them are in verse 5. What about the faithful witness? What does it mean to be a witness? To what does he witness? I met people the other day who belong to witnessing teams here in the state of Washington, are invited by a congregation in advance, and they come from various places, and they spend a weekend of witness in a local congregation. To what do they witness? What does it mean to be?
We say a witness is a person who has by firsthand experience observed a fact or a situation, and then has related this information to someone else in a testimony. This is my definition of a witness, and I think
we know that term from certain other contexts, don't we? Even a legal context. Mm-hmm. If you are, and so in the early church, and now also, there are those who bear testimony to what they, in their own experience, have learned of Christ and his saving activity in their lives and in the church.
It seems that Christ's witness was what he saw, what he experienced was God in his nature, and then what he testified to in regards to his revelation of, you know, the revelation of Christ as in the Gospels. He said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father, because I do what the Father does.
Right.
So he saw the Father in action, and then his testimony was his life, not only his, you know, atonement, but I think the totality of what he did when he was here.
Like the Gospel of John.
Is this what Paul is getting to when he calls Christ a witness? I mean,
well,
John, I'm sorry.
John. Yeah, I was wondering. Yeah, surely there may be a number of aspects of it, but the fact that he faithfully bears witness to the Father. Mm-hmm. Also, he bears witness to who he is, what he has been sent to be. Dangerous as that might be, acceptable as that might be to many of his people, and he even goes to death as in faithfulness to that which he has been sent to reveal. I don't know if there are other aspects of this. Can you think of that might be involved in this? The firstborn son is another of the titles. Now, obviously, we already encountered that in this 2 Samuel 7 passage in the Old Testament, a special relationship between the Anointed One and God, and adoption, perhaps, in that initial context. Here we discover one who is not just adopted, but who is the only begotten Son of the Father, the first born of this new age which he came to announce, and he is the one who was raised from the dead. That's very important in the book. But notice how in Revelation there is this tying together always of the one, not only the one who is raised, but he is also the one who was first slain. We'll encounter him in chapter 5 as the Lamb, but he's not just a living lamb, he is the one who bears yet the marks of his death. The ruler of the kings of this world, the next title. Christians of Asia Minor, to whom this letter was addressed, were confronted every day with the power of the Roman state, especially as it was represented by local authorities who had been placed there under Rome. And that power of Rome was going to make demands of them, which, in faithfulness to Christ, they could not obey. So it's, I think, intended to be a source of strengthening of the backbone against those Roman authorities, to be told that there is a king who is above those kings, or above the Caesar himself. Christ is the ruler of the kings of this world. God has put him there. He is not unknown figure from a remote corner of the world, a people with no political power of their own. You know, it may have sounded absurd to people outside the church to hear this, as it probably sounded to people in pre-Christian times to hear the glorious things that were spoken about the King of Israel. It made him sound like a world ruler, when actually, even at the greatest extent, it was just a rather small state. Now, there's something tremendously pretentious about claiming that Christ is the king of the rulers of this world. And there may have been, in the experience of some of those people, things that would lead them to question that. Christ had surely not, in his earthly life, accepted kingship which had been offered him by the people, and many of them fervently wished he had started a resistance movement of some kind. If he could do all the things they saw him doing, perhaps he could have succeeded, or others of these messianic pretenders had failed in driving the Romans out of their country. Christians, now they're not all Jews by any means, any longer, but still many of them are suffering from the power of this Roman state, and they would have likewise certainly loved to see some demonstrations of this power. Well, in this verse also a couple of things concerning his relationship. We said not only power, but immediately in that same verse, the one who loves us. Power and the mercy, they have to go together. It's a kind of two-edged crisis. Some people wondering whether God has any power. Some other people, maybe some of the same ones, wondering if he's really, if he cares, if he hears, if he loves his people. Assurance of both power and love. And then, for any who may be wondering about their own lack of faithfulness to God, he is the one who by his death frees us from our sins. The one matter which more than any other has disturbed the relationship is taken care of. Verse 6, he is one who has made us a kingdom of priests. Well, that comes right out of Old Testament again. That was the role which Israel was to be engaged in a relationship of mediating God to the nations. And so likewise the Christian community, in its witness, is to serve as a mediator between God and the people of the world. Verse 7 speaks about him as coming on the clouds. That, an expectation, which I think we find also in the Gospel, isn't it, Matthew, which may not side with our understanding, unless we have members of the Flat Earth Society here. Physically, I don't know quite how he can, that's a great problem, of course. But suggests surely his sovereignty again, his coming from the Father and being sent back into the world from which he once has come to be with the Father. Then in verse 13, we get into the experience of that particular area of the world. This blackboard is off somewhere else now. There's more than a Sunday afternoon journey involved, but seven congregations on a kind of circuit, somewhat, I suppose, served by this John, like the early American frontier might have been served by some pastors. Go on a journey from one congregation to the next. And these seven, I don't know that they're necessarily all on the same road, but beginning with Ephesus and going up and finally ending down in an arc at Laodicea. These churches apparently are represented here by lampstands, and Christ is the one who walks among them. That's symbolism. The apocalypses are full of it, and some of it is very difficult for us to understand. But lampstands were used elsewhere, in, for instance, the book of Zechariah. And here, since they have light on them, it, I think, is an apt symbol. If the church is there in a dark place, as those cities were in the heathen world, then they must keep their lamps burning and witness to the light that Christ has given them. It's a dangerous business too, and they may think they're very alone, but the promise is that Christ is walking among them. I think that's a very promissory note. There's a book, I saw it's on your shelf in here, that makes of those letters to the seven churches more rebuke and kind of threat. I guess I don't read Revelation that way. Surely there's facing up to reality and there is warning, but I think essentially it is promissory, it's hopeful, and it's intended to brace the faith of the congregations, those seven, to say, Christ is walking among you. You're not alone. He's wearing a robe and a gold band. Well, maybe that says something about his being the ruler of the kings of this world. We're not so sure, I think, about all of the imagery of the book of Revelation. At least I'm not, in spite of a number of years of studying it. The white hair and the eyes which blaze in verse 14. Well, the white hair may symbolize purity. It may also, since it may sound like something out of the book of Daniel, allude to his eternity. Some of us start getting gray hairs. Doesn't mean eternity, but old age, I guess. And the portrayal of the one on the white throne, white hair, perhaps eternity. Eyes which blaze, well, surely insight. Suppose they should know that he knows precisely what's going on. He isn't just an absentee lord of the church. He doesn't, maybe like Yahweh in a couple of cases in Genesis, have to come down to see whether the rumors he's been hearing are so. He's there. He knows what's going on. Maybe in the Old Testament context too, that's more just a part of the story than something one should theologize too much about. Eyes which blaze, well, surely insight. Suppose they should know that he knows precisely what's going on. He isn't just an absentee lord of the church. He doesn't, maybe like Yahweh in a couple of cases in Genesis, have to come down to see whether the rumors he's been hearing are so. He's there. He knows what's going on. Maybe in the Old Testament context too, that's more just a part of the story than something one should theologize too much about. Verse 15, he has feet that shine like brass. Well, elsewhere we've heard about some feet, a number of places in the Bible, one place in Daniel again, there are some feet of clay. Those are brittle, weak feet. And if you put a statue on feet like that and somebody crushes them, the whole thing falls over. Well, it's strange that the Christ should be portrayed as metal, but he's precious and he's strong, I guess. I guess that's what's being portrayed. A voice like a waterfall, or maybe it's translated somewhat elsewhere differently. Powerful. You have a number of places where the voice of God is portrayed as thunder or the sound of the sea. Powerful. Trumpet. Clear. Yes. There might be. Because he is an exalted figure again, as he was there. There might be some. I think those passages in the Gospels may have quite a bit of Old Testament imagery in them. And I've worked out through the end of chapter 14. The Old Testament imagery in the book of Revelation. And in some chapters there is scarcely a verse, but what it has background like that, and they may have both the same. In fact, some of this may come from, there's a great deal from Exodus, of the imagery here in this book, and in some of these chapters, also from Psalms and Daniel. So. Verse 16, seven stars in his right hand. Well, these stars, what are they? They are, in verse 20, identified as the angels of the churches. And angel may be a heavenly messenger, but it could also be an earthly one. And it's even been suggested that it might be the persons who came to John. If he was out there on that island of Patmos, could be, it was permitted on Visitor's Day for somebody to come out there. We suspect that through such a person, perhaps, these messages got back to the churches. So it might just be that these messengers of the churches ought to be comforted, strengthened by knowing that They're not just walking on their 2 feet or riding on a horse or whatever. They are in the hand of Christ. And if it is a more heavenly kind of guardian angel of each church, then that likewise. But church is not on its own resources. A two-edged sword from his mouth. Well, that doesn't... I don't know if any of you have ever seen a picture of Christ drawn that way. Surely it's not Solomon's picture of Christ. The two-edged sword from his mouth. Obviously, it's not intended to be taken literally, and one, I don't suppose, ought to hold God to it and say, well, you haven't fulfilled your promises until we see him with the sword out of his mouth. But it's, again, a symbol of power, and comes out of the psalm that is used to portray the power and victory of the Messiah. His face is bright as the midday sun. Well, there's glory and beauty. There's a lot of portrayal of God and Christ here also in kind of roundabout anthropomorphic human form. Descriptions that use hands and feet and mouth and so forth to describe God as though he were kind of a blown up, super proportioned human. Well, again, it points beyond itself here, I think, to describe his glory, his also the face shining, remember from the benediction. That is a word of grace, comfort, encouragement to the church. He confesses, I am the first and the last. Again, his continual existence, eternity. He didn't just come on the scene in whatever year it was that he was born, 4 or 7 BC or something, or 1, the year 1, I guess, isn't probably correct, but anyway, he... confesses he's been here long before that. He is the living one, verse 18, the one who was dead and is alive. And of course, Christians who are facing death need to be encouraged to believe that that's not the end. That being faithful to Christ will, in the long run, give them eternal life. Now, chapters 2 and 3 are a look at the church. And as certain other books, like Corinthians, one gets a picture which is not entirely what we'd like to hear about the early church. We'd, I suppose, like to think that, unlike us, they were pure and had only the most exemplary members. They didn't get into the petty kinds of squabbles and so forth that we might. But maybe for our encouragement, the scriptural record includes also the sorts of foibles and weaknesses, even gross things that existed in the early congregations. In these seven churches...
Excuse me, before we get into chapter 2, I'd like to go back to chapter 1.
Mm-hmm.
On verse 8,
yeah.
When God is saying that I am the Alpha and the Omega... those two words mean?
Yeah, they're just the first and last letters of the alphabet used, I guess, for beginning and end in a kind of symbolical way for God's ever presence. He isn't like us, ephemeral, here today, gone tomorrow. He was here before we came. In fact, he was from the beginning. He will also be here at the end. I think it's a symbol of that. And notice that although it's used in verse 8, it's a Christ, is it not? It's also used of God himself. So there are ways in which God and Christ are really very much identified and given the same titles sometimes here. Mm-hmm. I didn't think that I would do very much with chapters 2 and 3. Obviously, looking at the clock, I'll maybe even do less than that. But... just say that those churches are very realistically portrayed, and some of them in totally negative terms. In spite of that, they are still claimed by Christ, called His church. Their angel is in His hand, and He is walking still among them. He hasn't abandoned them in spite of all that. And I think, again, it's a note of encouragement as well as, of course, a warning. And two of the churches are only addressed in words of praise. So you have, I think, a comfortable balance if you want to believe that the early church did, in fact, have some positive features. Well, there are a couple of them. I think Philadelphia is one of them, where the congregations are really held up for as our example. I don't think that those seven churches are portraying, as some think, certain periods of church history. Those who look at that have generally a quite negative attitude over against the established church, and betray too little love for the church, I think, believing that it will only in the end be an apostate church to which Christ returns. I don't think so. I don't think that those seven churches refer to seven ages. I think they are simply seven churches of Asia, which were a part of John's congregation, and they are the ones to whom these letters were addressed, and they got back to them, were perhaps helpful in correcting certain situations in those congregations. They are, of course, preserved for our instruction. And the things that Christ lauded and commended in those congregations would be commendable today. The things which were kind of out of joint with His will, I think one should consider, would not be too much in His favor today either. So He would give us a comparable word of commendation or warning, depending upon whether we are faithful to Him or unfaithful to Him, as these congregations were. Chapter 4 is a portrayal of the Creator and the one who holds the whole universe in His hands. Again, there one has some very strong symbolical language, some of it portraying His power, other aspects of it portraying His love and mercy. We think, for instance, of His being on the throne as surely absolute power. We haven't any notion of that. I don't know if any of you have ever been to a country where your life was literally in the hand of the ruler of that country. Or if they didn't, for some reason, like you. Ever been to Uganda? You might still have a little reservoir of respect for your international status or something, but the citizens of that country, absolutely in the hand of the power of the ruler. He decides, off with your head. You have no recourse. Off with your head. Well, people to whom this was first addressed lived in a Roman state where the absolute authority of the government, the Caesar, was taken for granted. So when you speak of someone on the throne, that isn't just a grandfatherly kind figure, perhaps, to whom you are alluding necessarily, but I think it says something about He has the power of life and death over you and the whole community. So God, likewise, is one who has that kind of authority and power. It's maybe kind of helpful then in verse 3 to be shown the rainbow which surrounds the throne. That reminds us of Genesis 9, doesn't it? The end of the flood. God's promise. It's a, again, hopeful, promissory word. It's likewise, this chapter, a chapter of worship. And the book of Revelation is just full of that sort of thing. You are, like in chapters 2 and 3, down in this world among the weaknesses and dangers. And then all of a sudden you have the heavens opened up and you get a reprieve and you see what's going on in the very presence of God. And there it's always worship. Maybe this is the sort of thing that turns some people off because they don't much enjoy They're always watching the clock, if they go to service at all, for the time when it's going to be over. And the prospect of a worship service an eternity long, somehow, eek. Well, seems that those who are engaged in it are not finding it boring at all, but just very second nature, and it's a joyful thing, and they're singing the old songs and the new one. Chapter 4 and chapter 5, both scenes of worship. The Creator worshipped in chapter 4 by the redeemed community, I think representatives there of Old and New Testament, 24 elders, probably best explained by 12 apostles and 12 tribes of Israel or patriarchs. I don't know for sure that that's the case, but it would seem the most logical. Represented all the community of both testaments represented there. Likewise, all creation, the creatures before the throne. When you hear birds singing, are they singing their praise to God in this world? Well, I guess maybe various kinds of calls involved, including distress and so forth, but surely creation needs redemption and needs to sing God's praise too. And just as it was involved in the fall at the beginning, so it will be involved in the redemption at the end. And it is represented even in the presence of God by these living creatures. They are, of course, like people, representative. Not that everyone's there, but you are there in the one who represents you. The eagle, I suppose the flying creatures, the lion, the wild, the ox, the domesticated animals, and, well, apparently the end is at hand, and we see in the presence of God then that redemption of the whole creation has taken place. Chapter 5 is a picture of likewise a worship scene, the Lamb, the one who is worthy to open the scroll. There's apparently some great message which is sent. That's surely in the background, like in the ancient world, a king would send a message and he would seal it, and woe to the messenger if that was unsealed before it got to the proper person. If it was addressed to the king in the neighboring state and it got there with all the seals broken, I'm sure it would be heads off for the messenger who sent it. Here, the message is sent, and there is no one who is worthy to open it, but he dares to touch it. But finally, the seer, John, is pointed to one who has the right, perhaps the one who to whom it was addressed, and so he can open the seals. He is, well, he's called the Lion of Judah, but when you look at him, you see he's a lamb. Now, that's kind of strange, too. There's, of course, an identification here with the Old Testament imagery. He is the second David. But he's not one who uses his authority and power to crush, and like David did, to carve out an empire and to kill and so forth. But he is the gentle lamb. In fact, he is the one who bears yet the marks of his slaughter, but who has been made alive again. He is the great descendant of David, but he gave his life. And on behalf of that one, not just the old songs from the old covenant, but the new song which sings of his redemption, what he has done in his death for the people of God, that is what is sung. He is worthy, because of his death, to open the scroll. Well, what is the scroll about? We will encounter it in chapters 6 and 7, even a little bit in chapter 8. I guess that's where the seventh seal finally gets opened. That's been so variously understood. I guess I would opt for an interpretation of that scroll which says that it is an unfolding of sacred history, a history in which Christ is so intimately involved. God has from the time of Abraham, been very busy in this great rescue operation, bringing back into a relationship with himself all people. And the one who has the greatest of all of the roles to play in that is Christ. He is the one who therefore has the right to unroll this scroll that portrays the sacred history, particularly those last chapters of it, which are about to unfold. And you're going to see things in that which are not beautiful, and one wonders, how in the world can it be that he would be involved in such gruesome events? But of course, it seemed that the apocalypse takes very seriously the evils of this world and evil people and the forces of evil, Satan himself, and does not expect that there will be a great conversion of the hosts of wickedness to evil. They haven't just given up, even though they've been defeated in the death of Christ. And so they must go down fighting, I guess. There has to be a final great struggle. The world is not going to finally end up with everybody saluting the flag of God and saying, isn't it wonderful what he's done for us? There will be those, even in the face of all the evidence, there will be those who will say no, and we don't want it. And so the book portrays a kind of hardening of the lines, and it may be more possible to tell who's on one side or on the other in the end time than elsewhere. So there will be a great struggle, and Christ is intimately involved in it. He sends, in fact, judgments. God, maybe it's that sword from his mouth that portrays it the best. He's sitting on the throne. He's the second David. And yet, the ones who are finally won for him, they are won on the basis of his suffering love rather than of his mighty power. So I think that is, above all, the message to the church. But I think they must be assured that the power of Christ is equal to anything that Satan can send against him. He will win. Remember, you're on the winning side. Don't ever forget. And it doesn't matter what it is that is sent against you or that Christ perhaps permits when the scroll is opened, whether it's war or pestilence or famine, those four horses that come charging out when the first four seals are opened. Doesn't matter, it seems, what they are. Christ is still in control. And you mustn't think about those as an evidence that things have gotten out of hand and God is no longer on the throne. No, he is on the throne, and in fact, sacred history is still unfolding. But it somehow doesn't just end up in a great revival meeting where everybody is at long last converted. It ends up on the battlefield with the forces of God and those of Satan in pitched battle, and they just have it out. They go down fighting. They don't finally just come to their knees and capitulate. I guess it's quite clear I'm not a universalist. I now and then am given a little grace to love my enemies, but I still think there are those who will, God will not drag them off kicking and screaming in protest to an eternity of light and goodness. He, in his great love, gives us the freedom to say no. And some have said it with great finality and bitterness, ugliness. We're supposed to finish. Perhaps for coffee, I haven't heard a bell, but... Dear. over